The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
Mortgages up nearly 8%, mortgage applications, that is, last week. But this is a series of numbers. It has been in a steady downtrend. What is going on? Well, we're going to ask that question now of John Sereau. He's president, North Atlantic Mortgage Corp. He's also a member of the Government Affairs Committee for the National Association of Mortgage Professionals. John, welcome back.
Hi, Kathleen. Good to be back.
So let's start, first of all, by talking about what's going on in the mortgage market. I guess it's pretty easy. When rates come down, even the most cautious, sitting on the fence-est kind of potential home buyer says, you know what, maybe it's time to buy.
Yeah, that's true. Rates have come down quite a bit in the last 6 months. And so you have a lot of people out there that missed the boat last time. They have another opportunity now, whether it be to buy a home or refinance a home. And so you're seeing people jump back into the market again. And that's why we have that rise in mortgage applications.
So this is something, of course, with the 30-year fixed rate currently at 4.625% or thereabouts. Is this a rate that we could see? It's hard to believe it could get much lower than that right now, right? Unless the economy suddenly, you know, went bust again.
Well, that's true. You know, 4.625% is a great interest rate. And, you know, I remember the days, and many of us remember the days of the 21.5% interest rates out of the Carter years. So 4.625, you know, is phenomenal. And you know, anyone who is waiting to see if that's going to go lower, I wouldn't hold my breath. If anything, you know, the trend is for rates to move higher, not lower. While we have this opportunity that rates have fallen again, people should be taking advantage of it, buying a home or refinancing, because it's not going to last.
Okay. And I guess with the Federal Reserve, we're going to get the minutes at 2 o'clock Eastern. We'll be having that live breaking news with Vinnie Del Giudice from the Treasury Newsroom in Washington, and then Vince Reinhardt, who's the former Director of Monetary Affairs at the Board of Governors, Federal Reserve in Washington, will be going over those minutes with us. And I assume, John, you expect what everybody else does. QE2's over. And the Fed maybe then, as Jim Bullard told my colleagues Mike McKee and Sarah Eisen earlier today, he's president of the St. Louis Fed, the Fed just keeps it on hold for a while then.
Yeah. You know, you have to ask yourself, who's going to pick up the slack since the Fed isn't going to be buying these bonds any longer? That's what really helped this market to improve, is that there's somebody, they're printing money, they're buying bonds. But, you know, once that is over, who's going to be buying these bonds? And if there's nobody buying these bonds, how are these rates going to keep from moving higher?
Well, but we know there won't be nobody buying the bonds.
We know that. But the Chinese have, you know, I don't want to say they've maxed themselves out, but the Chinese and the Japanese are, you know, responsible for buying the bulk of these bonds. And it's law of supply and demand. So it's yet to be seen whether or not we're going to see that demand still be as high as it has. And once you take the Fed out of the picture from buying bonds, obviously, you know, there's going to be less bonds purchased and, you know, and the price of the bonds will go lower and the rates will go higher.
How much higher do you see bond yields and mortgage rates going?
Hard to say. I would not be surprised if we saw a 0.5% increase before the end of the year in the Fed rate, as mentioned by one of the Federal Reserve Bank, I think it was a Federal Reserve Bank gentleman out of Minneapolis last week?
Yes, Narayana Kocherlakota, president of the Minneapolis Fed.
Yeah, I'm glad you said his name and I didn't have to, because I could have never pronounced it. So
you'll get better, because that's a name you're going to be hearing for some time.
He's I'm sure
one of the intellectual heavyweights there, as most of those Fed officials are. So your sense then, but you know, to see a half percentage point increase even by the Fed, how much difference would that make for long term rates? I mean, again, we're really going to key that fixed rate, that 30-year fixed rate, off the 10-year note, say, more than where the Fed funds is?
Well, yes and no, because the rates aren't exactly tied to the 10-year note. Mortgage rates are tied to Fannie Mae bonds. And so it really is going to depend on the price of the Fannie Mae bond, not necessarily the 10-year.
So yes, what's going to determine that?
Well, what's going to determine that is the demand for Fannie Mae bonds, as I said earlier. You know, depending on how much demand there is for those bonds, that will dictate that will dictate rates. But the 10-year note and the Fed funds rate, while they have psychological implications on mortgage rates, there is no direct correlation with the rates themselves. It's really going to come down to demand for Fannie Mae bonds.
Well, you know, if we saw, say, a half percentage point increase in, say, the 30-year fixed rate, be just over 5%, what's the level, John, where you say, uh-oh, that's really going to put a burden on a market that really hasn't, you know, picked up any steam yet? If anything, people are still worried about falling home prices, big inventory overhang, and a housing market that's going to be, you know, kind of in the dumps for the next couple of years.
Well, to answer that question, you know, I would tell you we're probably already there. I don't know that we need to see rates go higher for the real estate industry and housing market to have added pressure on. We already have pressure from many different areas that are hurting the real estate market, and it's not just interest rates.
Talk to us about the refinancing, because this is good for homeowners, right? So it's good for the consumer. Maybe you save some money. This is something that in past episodes in the economy, John, as you know, has been one of the things giving a little more juice to growth.
Yes, that's right. That's correct. And certainly people should be taking advantage of that right now and not waiting to see if rates go lower. You know, we were talking about what would add further pressure to the market, to the real estate market, the mortgage market. And there are two things I want to point out that people need to be aware of. The first thing is that comes October, the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac jumbo loan limits will cease to exist, and they will be rolled back from $729,000 in what we call high-cost areas like the metropolitan area of New York, Fairfield County, Connecticut, in the high-end areas. You could get a jumbo loan up to $729,000 right now at a favorable rate. That's going to be scaled back to $625,000 comes October. That's going to hurt. Because now when people have to get a jumbo mortgage, they're not going to get a favorable rate, and they'll really have difficulty getting a jumbo mortgage because, as you know, nobody's securitizing them right now. So that's one thing that the consumer has to watch out for. So if they're buying or refinancing, you want to lock into something certainly before October. The other thing I want to point out that's very important is that there will be no housing recovery whatsoever if the government stays with a qualified residential mortgage definition at a 20% down payment. That is what is in Dodd-Frank, and that is going to be extremely damaging to the real estate market.
Okay, let's focus on that because, you know, for many years that was what everybody had to do. I think when my parents bought their first house, they probably had something like a 20% down, and, you know, there was only 30-year fixed rates pretty much. And it seems that one of the reasons we've had problems is because if you have people bought homes they couldn't afford because they didn't have to put down a down payment. And also when you have no skin in the game, you know, it's easier to make a decision and say, what the heck? Because, you know, if you don't have a down, if you have no down payment, for example, it's kind of like renting a house, right?
Right.
So what is the right solution? Would you say, should we go back to no down payment, or are you just think 20% is too much? What do you think?
I think that 20% is certainly going to hurt the market. I don't think that it should be left at 20% down. The reason why we got into this mess was because of poor underwriting standards, and you know that doesn't exist anymore. These bad loans are gone. It's kind of like the drug Vioxx. You know, when the drug Vioxx was killing all of these people, they got rid of the drug. Okay. The point is the bad loans are gone, and underwriting standards have tightened up to the extreme, you know, to the point where they're over-tightening now. Underwriters for the lenders and for Fannie and Freddie have cleaned up their acts somewhat. They're being very strict about underwriting. So if you were putting 10% down or 5% down, you have to meet all the other criteria. Not the way it was in 2004 to 2006. You have to have income, you have to have good credit, you have to have reserves in the bank, and you have to have good job stability. That's what they're going to look at. And if you can do that, then there's nothing wrong with putting less than 20% down. Yes, I agree, the more skin in the game, the less chance that you're going to walk away from the home. However, there are a lot of people out there today can't do 20% down. And if you don't let those people come into the market, you're going to have more difficulties with real estate trying to gain traction again.
So are you saying then, let's look particularly at this, the tighter underwriting standards and the regulators and Fannie and Freddie, everybody's saying, you know, this is the kind of gone back to the future. We're being strict again. We're really paying attention. When it comes to income, are you saying that the underwriting standards are such that that people are looking at that again and saying, well, gee, if you're making $50,000 a year, you can't buy a $50,000 house?
Correct. Absolutely. They're looking at income. They want to use the traditional Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac underwriting guidelines regarding income of 28% of your gross income for your housing expense, including taxes and insurance, and 36% for your overall indebtedness, housing expenses, plus any other monthly debts that you have. That's textbook. And if you stay with that, that's a pretty comfortable number for the banks to have when qualifying borrowers. Some of these ratios do go higher, 40%, 42%. Now you start getting into the realm where it's getting risky. But you know what? They'll go higher on those ratios if you have more money down. So while the underwriting standards are tighter, there's nothing really terribly wrong about that. They do have to be a little bit more realistic and use some common sense sometimes, because automated underwriting, which is underwriting done through computers, doesn't have that human element in it and doesn't allow for judgment calls. But as far as qualifying income-wise, credit-wise, and asset-wise, that's going to be the case going forward. What's really going to add pressure is overregulation from Washington.
So who in Washington, John, is pressing for the 20% mandatory down payment? Who's pressing against it? How do you see these forces playing out?
Well, who's pressing against it are the supporters of the Dodd-Frank bill, the Democratic Congress. I was in Washington in March. I met with the members of the House Financial Services Committee. And I can tell you that it's pretty much split right down the line. You have your Republicans, your Democrats. Republicans are against all of this regulation, particularly the new freshman Republicans, and the Democrats are against it. The Federal Reserve also plays a big part in this, where they're meddling again in dictating compensation models within the mortgage industry, which they should not be doing that. They're setting precedent to do the same in other businesses, starting with the auto industry next. And imagine this, if you're a business owner, and the government tells you how much you can pay, how much you can make for your service or product, and how much you can pay your employees, that is ridiculous.
Okay, John Searle, thanks for joining us today. President of North Atlantic Mortgage Corp. Now we turn to a new book written by somebody. I always love it when anybody who writes an economist or economics book does so well. I guess it has something to do with the skill of the author, though, because this can be the dismal science. But in Tim Harford hands, it turns into something entertaining and intriguing. He is a senior columnist for the Financial Times. His undercover economist takes a look at economic ideas behind everyday experiences. His latest book is called Adapt: Why Success Always Starts with Failure. Tim, welcome.
Thank you.
So what drew you to this topic? Is it your own failures that led to success?
I'm quite happy to talk about my own failures. There have been far too many of them. But no, that's not where I started. I appropriately enough for the book, which is really about experimentation and trial and error, I didn't start with this big concept of experimentation and trial and error. Instead, I started trying to write a book about, well, how to save the world. How do we solve our big problems?
I've always wanted to do that too.
Yeah, the financial crisis, poverty in Africa, terrorism, wars. How do we solve all these big problems? How do we promote innovation? All this stuff. And that was where I started. And it was only as I started to look at these very complex problems in a very complex world that I came to realize, you know, there is a pattern here. All of these problems can only be solved through a process of experimentation. And that's why the subtitle of the book, a little bit exaggeration, but yeah, success always starts with failure.
Well, you know, one thing that caught my eye, and certainly as a journalist, you know, you're a journalist too, right? We get experts in our stories to quote. We get them on our radio show to do an interview. Tell us about Mr. Tetlock and what he found with experts.
So Philip Tetlock is a psychologist, and he, in the mid-1980s, was given the job of trying to figure out what social sciences could contribute to understanding the Cold War, which is 1985. It's the biggest problem in the world, right? Thermonuclear war might happen. And so he went and he interviewed a bunch of people, all kinds of experts on the Soviet Union, Russian speakers and dissidents and diplomats and journalists and academics. And what he found was they disagreed about everything. And that led him to say, well, what use is expert judgment if the experts can't make up their minds? He spent 2 decades then collecting expert forecasts on all fields of economics and politics from all kinds of experts. And he just did something very simple. He took careful notes and he waited. And then 20 years later, he looked at all these forecasts and basically found that you might as well have asked a bunch of monkeys, because no experts, you know, got anything right in any field. And normally when people hear that story, because Tetlock's work is now quite widely written about, it's been written about, for instance, in The Black Swan by Taleb. When people hear the story, they think, experts, they're all just a bunch of charlatans. But actually, no, that's clearly not true. Clearly, expertise is valuable, but it's not valuable for navigating your way through this tremendously complex world, not valuable for forecasting, because there's just too much going on. There are too many variables. And so the lesson I draw from Tetlock's work is not, experts are frauds. It's the world is too complex to fully understand. And that is why experimentation, why trial and error is so essential.
Well, I think you, also at the beginning of the book, you start with a classic example of, actually sort of like success leading to failure, right? Or maybe failure does lead. One person's success leads to his failure, but then it leads to success for the world.
Yeah. So, well, I'm not even sure which example you're talking about, because there are so many.
Mr. Gutenberg.
So, earlier today, I was in the New York Public Library because the Gutenberg Bible is there. So it was a privilege. It's the first time I've seen a copy of this book. So Johannes Gutenberg, the inventor of the movable type printing press, and therefore, in some ways, the predecessor of all modern books, in some ways, he created the modern world in the 1450s. And he made this beautiful Bible, the Gutenberg Bible, or sometimes called the 42-line Bible. Beautiful, beautiful book. And that's normally what people talk about. They talk about Gutenberg and his amazing invention and his amazing Bible. What they don't say is the Gutenberg Bible drove Gutenberg into bankruptcy. He went too far into debt. He fell out with a business partner. And the whole project for Gutenberg was a failure. For civilization, it was a tremendous success. And funnily enough, the early printing industry, they had to go through this process of trial and error, because it seemed like, what's the obvious thing to do? You've got a printing press. What are you going to print? You print the Bible. The Bible is the great book, especially in 1450. But actually, it turns out that's not very sensible, because there's not a lot of demand for Bibles and people are willing to pay a lot for handwritten Bibles. There's no particular reason to print it. So you know what the actual business model at work was? They started printing papal indulgences, which are basically one-page flyers from the Pope saying you get time off, going to heaven. And in retrospect, you go, oh, yeah, of course. You just print one page that was the same every time and was really valuable. But they just didn't figure that out first time around, because we hardly ever do. We're always just fumbling along, companies going bankrupt, people failing, and then finally we figure out how to do it.
I've always felt that in my life, that I sort of have stumbled along from thing to thing. But tell us about Peter Palczynski, one of the heroes in your book.
So Palczynski, in a nutshell, he's the engineer who told Joseph Stalin he was wrong.
What happened to him?
Yeah, well, I think you can guess. He didn't last that long. I mean, Palczynski, he's a hero, but he's also this tragic comic character, because he just couldn't keep his mouth shut. So not only does he tell Stalin he's wrong, he does things like he tells his wife, I've been traveling around Europe. I've had an affair. I hope you don't mind. I hope you understand. I mean, he's just compulsive honesty. And of course, it got him killed in the end. But the reason I wanted to tell Palczynski's story and the story of the Soviet Union, I mean, we all know the Soviet system didn't work. It collapsed. Fine. But why? It was a failure to adapt. It was a failure to be able to experiment and to figure out what was going wrong.
My guest is Tim Harford. He is the Financial Times undercover economist, out with yet another book called Adapt: Why Success Always Starts with Failure. And again, just the title, Tim, to me is sort of reassuring, because we all have failures and our failures can get us down. But yours is, this is something that's not just sort of a, what do I want to say, a homily or a preaching. It's looking at human behavior. It's looking at what's happened over the years with businesses and artists and governments to find this, these principles, to give us examples. Let's get back to Peter Pilczynski for a minute. The guy who told Stalin, hey, you're all wrong. And so that was the end for him.
That didn't work out so well.
But his principles, you kind of weave throughout your book.
Yeah, so what was going on when Pilczynski was criticizing Stalin's, these are big engineering projects that Stalin wanted. It's huge, the biggest dam in the world, biggest hydroelectric dam in the world. A city called Magnet Mountain City that was going to produce as much steel as the entire United Kingdom, just one city. It was huge, huge projects. And Pilczynski developed a sort of critique of these projects that actually has much wider application, because it's really all about how to experiment and fail productively. So the first thing is you need to get lots and lots of ideas. You need to travel widely. You need pluralism. You need to be experimenting on many different fronts, because we just don't know what's going to work. Second, those experiments have to be small. If you have a great big experiment, maybe every bank in the world plunges into subprime derivatives.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, you remember that one? If you have a great big experiment, that's a disaster if it goes wrong, and things do go wrong. But if you've got lots of small experiments, like, say, Silicon Valley, no one expects everything in Silicon Valley to work out. We don't need everything to work out. We just need some of it to work out, and the good ideas will spread. So those are the first two principles. The third principle is to know when something is working or when something isn't. And that sounds so simple. And in some cases it is. I mean, if you open, say, a coffee shop, you know if it's not working because the customers don't come in through the door, and eventually you'll go bankrupt if you're not careful. But in many other walks of life, it's not so easy. So anything from politics, where politicians are not keen to road test their ideas because they're embarrassed. If they prove, they do a proper test and they show their policy doesn't work, that's embarrassing. So they don't usually ask too many questions. But it's true in our personal lives as well. You know, so often we make a mistake and, you know, our friends gather around and they do what friends do. You know, they support us and they tell us, you know, well,
that's
that guy,
okay.
That was okay. That you're great. Forget that guy, or your boss is an idiot. And maybe sometimes they should be saying, well, you know, the reason why he acted like that, or the reason why you didn't get that promotion, you know, maybe you need to change something.
You shouldn't come to work drunk every day. Yeah,
yeah, maybe not.
So let's try if we can quickly go through some of the big themes in the book, because there's so much here. It's so rich, so many examples, so much history. And it's not just important personally. I think even investors and people thinking about companies and investments, it's very important. But one of the things, conflict or how organizations learn, what's the message there?
So I looked at what happened in the war in Iraq, and this was a real surprise to me. I took on the challenge because I thought, well, you know, war is a complex problem. So if I want to write a book about complex problems, I need to understand what happened. And it was a real surprise to me because I think the narrative we tell about the war in Iraq was you had a bad strategy and a bad leader, and then we got a good leader. We got General Petraeus, who everybody thinks is a really great leader, or many people think is a great leader, and he fixed it. And then this disaster was turned around and we got this fragile success in Iraq instead. And looking at what happened, that wasn't really the way it happened at all. I mean, Petraeus is a great leader, but the reason he's a great leader is because he understood that the U.S. Army was already adapting. There were experiments going on the ground. Colonels, majors, more junior officers, realizing the strategy wasn't working, and despite heavy discouragement from their superior officers, just adapting, experimenting, figuring out what was working. And of course, once somebody had a good idea, a tactic that was working in one city, his peers would copy him and they'd try the same thing themselves.
Preventing financial meltdowns is another one of your big overarching themes in the book, decoupling.
Yeah. So the big lesson from the financial crisis, the obvious lesson is, hey, maybe failure doesn't always lead to success.
Yeah.
Maybe failure just leads to failure. But the lesson there is, well, we have the phrase now, too big to fail. We got a situation where, unlike normally in a market, if you've got a bad business, a bad business model, you'll go out of business, you'll be replaced by somebody with a better business model. And that is the process. That's how competition works. It's also how economic growth works. Economic growth works because ideas that aren't working so well are replaced with ideas that are working well. But that's not how it was working in Wall Street. Instead, what you had was a situation where one bad decision one failing institution could threaten another and another and another. And what I learned was actually the way to look at this kind of system was to draw on principles from safety engineering, from the people who try to understand, say, how oil platforms blow up or nuclear power stations melt down. As they understand these systems that are very, very tightly coupled together, one error can lead to a second error and a third and a fourth before you can do anything about it. And making those systems safe involves something that engineers call decoupling. So you can't prevent the failure, but you can prevent the failure, you know, affecting other parts of the system. So we need to get rid of too big to fail. We don't need to get rid of failure on Wall Street. We can't get rid of failure on Wall Street, but we can hopefully get rid of too big to fail.
So final question, the adaptive organization, again, because I'm thinking for investors, for, you know, people understanding their own companies and themselves, what does it look like? What are the key elements of the adaptive organization?
So let's remember those three Peter Palchinsky principles. So lots of pluralism, lots of different ideas. The ideas need to be small at first, so they're not dangerous if they fail. And you need to have a good way of figuring out which ideas are working and which ideas aren't. And you can see that in some Silicon Valley firms. So Google is obviously a company that everyone talks about. They encourage their engineers to experiment, to come up with new ideas. They put them out in beta. They let customers look at them and play with them, and they get rid of them if they're not working. But it's true in other firms as well. So I have examples even as simple as a humble Main Street key-cutting firm in the UK using similar principles. So it's not just for Silicon Valley.
Tim Harford, the undercover economist. Adapt, why success always starts with failure. Thanks for joining us today, Tim.
Thank you very much.
Real pleasure.
You can subscribe to Bloomberg's premium podcast service at Bloomberg.com/Tom Keene and listen to The Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM satellite radio channel 113. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.